You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
It's the first time that Apple have actually decided to tell people about something that they're developing.
High-speed broadband. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
The three main spamming countries are the United States, China, and South Korea.
And I've got some residual powers.
Sounds like something out of Harry Potter.
Senator Coonan, the voice of reason.
There's a couple of systems on a gantry that's actually based on a military missile tracking system.
You put the date on ePrey, and you get a whole service just on it.
How does it go?
IE7, you were having trouble installing it because you had a genuine copy of Windows that wouldn't validate properly. What did you have to do to get past that?
Built a new machine.
But how hard can it be?
Well, it's not hard at all.
At the end of the day, the photography is all about the person's eye and what they see.
If you find something that's inappropriate about your child, you need to do something about it because it will not go away.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the summer series of Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb. While we all take a well-earned break over the holiday period, we're going to revisit some of the more memorable programs from the past few years in the lead-up to our return in February 2008. As I mentioned last week, one of the great things about Tech Talk Radio is meeting and talking to people who are leaders in their fields. Tonight's show is no different. We hear from two guests who know everything there is to know about the world's biggest search engines. Adam Lasnik heads up search for Google and has the enviable title of Search Engine Evangelist. And if that isn't enough, Hugh Williams from Microsoft tells us about image search on Microsoft Live. For those of you who don't know, Hugh is an Australian, born and bred and educated in Melbourne. He now lives and works at Microsoft's home base at Redmond in the United States. So whichever is your favourite search engine, stick with us for the inside knowledge on what makes these search engines tick. We'll also hear from Adam Turner, and Dr. Ron tells us about the rise of copper theft in Australia. So stay tuned to Tech Talk Radio as we join Hugh Williams, Development Manager at Microsoft's Live Search.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hugh, you were a student at RMIT in the early 80s, which coincidentally was the same time that I was there. So how does a Melbourne boy find himself living and working for the world's largest software company some 25 years later?
That's a long story, Andrew. So I was actually there in the late 80s at RMIT, so you're making me a little older than I really am. But I was there from 88 to 90, and then after that, I ventured out into the software world. I started up my own consultancy, actually, and did a lot of consulting to Telstra, a few other places. And I guess around 1993 or so, I found what I was doing wasn't really engaging, and so I went back to RMIT, met up with a guy there who was interested in searching DNA and protein databases, which was an interesting problem.
And you hang out with all the good guys, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. And so I decided to do a PhD with this guy, and spent about 3 years doing that. Finished that in 96, 97, somewhere around there. And despite the best intentions, at the time my intentions were to go back and do something in the software industry. I actually stuck around at RMIT. So I took a job as a lecturer there. I ended up being a senior lecturer there. Finally got to being an associate professor there. And all through that period, learned lots of teaching, lots of research, and my research work sort of moved into the search area. So I was researching aspects of web search, things like crawling, searching documents, interfaces for searching, all those kinds of things, all sorts of things that were being done at the time by big search companies, some of those giants that you probably remember from the 90s, like Alta Vista and Excite and Lycos and those kinds of guys. So I've kind of into search pretty early in the web, really. And at some point, I guess I got sick of publishing papers, and I wanted to be doing something a little bit more impactful. And it was somewhat of a coincidence that Microsoft was getting into the search space. So I spoke to some people that I knew there. I was pretty well connected in the search world at the time, and really found it that the team could paint a really believable story for me. There was this little startup group in Microsoft, and it was full of you know, very ambitious, very driven people.
Was this here in Australia or was this in the US?
This was in the US, yeah. There's actually a couple of Australians working there who I knew pretty well, and ended up going over there and talking to the team, spent a few days there, had an interview, all the kinds of standard things you do, and just really hit it off with the guys. I sort of thought it was a fantastic environment, small team, sort of startup culture, but, you know, obviously backed by, you know, the enormous backing of Microsoft. So I decided to leave Australia, took the family and moved up to Seattle and been there ever since.
All right. Your business card states that you're a principal developer for Live Search. What does the job description entail for that?
Well, that's a good question. So it's a bit of research, a bit of development. I think it's one of those jobs that sits pretty much down the middle. What I'm really involved in is trying to conceive ways to meet users' information needs. So, you know, we know out there that users of the web are frustrated by search. You know, only around 50% of the users who use search engines get an answer to their information need. So my job is to try and bridge the gap between that 50% that are getting what they want and the 100% that we'd love to give everybody. So really, my job is to sit around and look at opportunities to improve search. I work across the multimedia space. I work across news search. I work across instant answers. And I'm lucky enough to also work on the core of the web searching algorithm. I do a lot of work with Microsoft Research as well. So I put my research training, I guess, into practice as well, trying to sort of bring people together across the company to work on search.
So tell me about your team. How many people work in the search team, and what's the job diversity like?
It's a moderate sized team. Not incredibly large. I think it's still got that really good startup feel about it. But the diversity is really there. We've got people with backgrounds like mine, so track record in research, lots of publications. We've moved into a development organisation and want to ship software. We've got lots of people who are sort of fresh out of PhDs in the team. We've got guys who've got double degrees in perhaps engineering and computer science. Lots of straight computer science graduates, and there's even a guy on my team actually who's got a history degree, and he's just a fabulous computer scientist. So a real mix of people, very diverse backgrounds. It's a very multicultural team. Lots of guys from China, from India, from Australia, all over the world.
The online world is evolving at breakneck speed, with bandwidth becoming cheaper, faster, and the use of rich media on the web, such as high-res images, audio such as podcasts, and the plethora of video pop-ups that are starting to hit the site, such as YouTube. The next generation of search engine must certainly have its job cut out for it. How's the search engine evolved over the past decade or so and into the selective and highly skilled beast that it certainly has become today?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there's been a lot of evolution in the search space. I mean, I think if you wind the clock back 7 or 8 or 9 years, I think, search to most people really simply meant, typing in a query and getting back 10 blue links. And there was not much more to it than that. There was blue links and some advertising. If you look at what we've got now, it's a very rich environment. We've got tools like video search, and video now, as I'm sure you're really alluding to, is something that consumers, users out there, not only consume but also create. This is a huge emerging, exponentially growing area. So video search has become important. With the advent of the digital camera and the fact that just about everybody has one now, there's an enormous amount of image data being created and put up on the web through photo sharing sites. So searching over those is incredibly important. So we're seeing things like video search, we're seeing things like image search, we're seeing very integrated news search experiences that bring together clusters of articles that are published around the world and mix those with multimedia. We're seeing even on the core web tab, some significant evolution. We see things like instant answers, as an incredible part of what we do. One of our goals is very much to reduce the time from when a user queries to when they get their answer. And instant answers are a way where we can actually take answers and put those front and center at the top of the web tab. So we do things like give people stock prices or share prices. We tell you what the weather is. We answer using facts from Encarta, so you can ask questions like, what's the population of China? And we can give you a, an authoritative fact at the top of the screen. We can give you sneak previews of images and videos, teasers before you go into the vertical and fully immerse yourself in the experience. And recently, I guess it must be about 8 or 9 months ago, we shipped a related searches feature in our web search. So when you type a query, we can actually suggest other queries that you might want to try. And that's a fantastic tool, if you're trying to do research. You're in there and you're looking for a digital camera, we can actually start to suggest companies, model names, all those kinds of things. So you can really lead you through a querying experience that hopefully, reduces the time from when you pose the query to when you get the answer. So it's certainly very, very evolving. I think we're seeing a lot more integration across these different media types, and we're being a lot more imaginative about how to solve problems. But still a long way to go. It's a very, very fast-moving space, as you pointed out.
Let's talk a little bit about, searching for images a bit. How many images are actually indexed these days? Like, there must be billions of them on the internet, and what are the most popular ones?
Yeah, well, most definitely there's billions out there. The image space is massive, and if you go and count things like all those little page decorations, you count all those little balls and lines and, Amazon logos and things that are out there, there's billions and billions and billions of images. And certainly our goal is to collect all of those and put those in a central place where you can find them. It's a massive growing space. When we built the site, we really sat down and did some really deep digging in the data to try and figure out what our users really wanted. And I think when you use live search images, you'll see that we have a profoundly different user experience. It doesn't hit you right over the head. It's one of those things you sort of learn to use and immerse yourself in. But it's a profoundly different experience. One of the things I think that's really key in the difference in our engine is that we've removed the paging behavior that you're probably used to in search.
Yeah, so, it's one of the things I like about it, actually. You can actually just scroll down and not have to go next, next, next.
Yeah, and that was a direct response to what we found in the data.
All right, let's talk a little bit about what's under the hood. Nodules are the key to indexing an image. What's a nodule and why are they so important?
Ah, now you're getting into the technical stuff.
So yeah.
This is one of those things where I start waving my arms around and trying to explain things. So I'll try and do my best my best over the phone to explain the idea. But basically, when you're searching for an image on the web, you're not really searching the image itself. What you're doing is you're typing in a query that's text. So you're typing something like Britney Spears, and what you're asking us to do is to find images that are in the context of the text Britney Spears. So really, what you probably want as a result are images that occur on pages that contain the text Britney Spears. And so we have to have a way of representing that internally within our search engine. We have to have a way of expressing what text is associated with an image. So we call that a nodule. So we basically go and process web pages, and we extract meaningful text that we're sure is associated with an image, and we annotate that image with that text. And that little document, that little thing that describes that image, we call it a nodule. So our collection of images that you can search is billions of images, and each one of those images we call a nodule.
All right, now let's talk about indexing pages for a sec. Is the spider the image used different to the spider that the main search engines use? Like, have you written your own custom bot to actually go and find pictures?
Yeah, that's right. So we have a media crawler that goes out and fetches media, and that's distinct from our web crawler that goes out and fetches web pages. The reason for that is that they're architecturally quite different. It turns out that the steps you need to go and fetch a page and then go and fetch all the images and create these nodules, it's quite a different process architecturally to just going out and fetching web pages. So the web guys have kind of got it easy. Their crawler just fetches pages. It ignores images. We've got the tough problem. We've got to not only go and get the page and process it, but we've got to then go and get the images, the video, audio files, those kinds of things, and bring those back as well. The other thing that's really different about multimedia is these are much larger files. So pulling down a web page, is fairly trivial. Pulling down a huge image or a large video consumes much more bandwidth. You have to be much, much more careful about, what you pull down, because you want to spend that bandwidth as wisely as you can to build the best possible, freshest collection. And so there's, you know, there's architecturally a whole bunch of tricks that are different in multimedia. So we basically separate out the crawling processes based on the same technology, but architecturally, the result is quite a lot different.
And you probably have the bigger hard drives because you've got more images and more information to store, I'd suspect.
That's it. Definitely for. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Does Image Spider respect the laws of traditional indexing processes, such as links on web pages and other robots.txt files and the likes?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, all of our crawlers follow the robot.txt standard.
Adult images, obviously problematic because we all like a safe environment online these days. What precautions are taken to ensure the safe online experiences for the youngsters?
Well, you know, we do everything we possibly can to provide a safe searching environment. It's a super hard challenge for us, but we've used every technique that we can come up with to enable that, and we just double down every month and try and improve those techniques, add more techniques, and build a safe environment. But the kinds of things we need to do to provide those kinds of to provide a really safe environment are many and varied. So, for example, I'll illustrate a little. If you set up a web page and you start running adult advertisements on that page, then we can probably infer that you're an adult site. So, from a web perspective, if you're linking in advertisements from an adult advertiser, then we can almost assume that you're an adult site. Another thing that we do is we do some image processing. So we do things. Now we pull down an image. We do some face detection. We try and determine if the image contains a face. If it does, then we'll do some skin detection. We'll try and look for skin within that image, and then we'll try and classify that skin as being adult or non-adult. So we're doing all sorts of different things. They're just two of the techniques that we use. But we're carrying out a multi-step process on every page and every image that we pull down to try and best determine whether it's a safe page or whether it has adult content.
All right, now I'm keeping in theme with Britney Spears at the moment. Duplicates. There must be tens of thousands of Britney Spears lookalikes and likewise. How do you actually prevent a system like that from indexing every or presenting to the user every image of Britney Spears that there is online? Because there'd be plenty.
Yeah, that's a super hard problem, Andrew. It's a really, really tough one. What we do at the moment is we remove exact duplicates. And what I mean by that is we take the image and we push it through a mathematical function, and out the end comes a little signature. And if two images have exactly the same signature, then we know that it's the same file, hosted in two different places. You know, it's got the same dimensions, the same image type. You know, it's exactly the same image. And in that case, we'll only show the highest ranked duplicate. So if there's, if an image is, syndicated around the web, and it's exactly the same, then you'll only see one of them.
Let's talk about video and audio. What's the future here? What are we going to be seeing in respect to podcast audio and videos on all the million and one, these great Facebook, YouTube things that are popping up around the place?
So what I can tell you is that I'm pretty excited about and working on video search right now. It'll be one of those things where I just have to say stay tuned to this space. You can expect to see something happening from my team pretty soon in the video space.
Just for listeners' point of view, the only thing I can think of would be you would collect video information, or you'd find a video clip, you'd do a speech-to-text recognition and then make that searchable. Is that sort of along the lines of what we're going to be seeing in the future of search, regardless of who provides it in the foreseeable?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think with video, there's essentially two different kinds of search that are possible. You know, one is something that's very analogous to what we talked about with image search. You know, you basically take textual clues from web pages and use those as the tools to allow you to search. And then the other way you can go at the problem is, as you point out, is to actually dive within the video itself and do things like closed caption decoding. So, you know, we were all used to pressing the closed caption button and seeing closed captions. You can decode those and index that text and make that searchable. Or as you point out, you know, you can do speech to text on the audio and actually produce your own text from broadcasts that might not contain closed caption data. And that allows you to actually search within the video. So not only can you just find a video as sort of a one big element that matches some text on a web page, but you can actually get within the video and show people the relevant parts of the video. There's certainly interest in both of those. I think you know, a great video search engine would absolutely need to do both. But right now, the very vast majority of products that are out there only do the first scenario. I haven't really seen anybody make great steps into the second. Speech-to-text is pretty hard. You know, it's possible to train up a speech-to-text model so that it'll work really well for one type of video. So, for example, you know, we could train up a model that would work fantastically well for your podcast, but it might not work so well for, you know, a football podcast or a soccer podcast or a podcast that's has a native speaker from America. So it's one of those fickle little areas where you've got to get the system just right for each kind of environment. It's very hard to build a robust speech-to-text engine that can handle all the variety of audio and video data that you find out on the web. So it's a hard problem, but it's one that obviously you can tell from my excitement about it that I'm really, really interested in. Microsoft Research Asia has made enormous progress in that area. They've been doing some great work in that area for 5 to 10 years. There's a speech server group up in Redmond who've been working hard on this problem, and you might have heard that Microsoft recently acquired Telme Networks, who've done a lot of work in this area. So it's certainly a hot area within Microsoft, but getting it to be robust enough so it works right across all that heterogeneous content that's out on the web is a really, really hard problem.
Finally, the crystal ball, Hugh. 10 years ago, we remember way back then what the net was like. It's nothing like what it is today. 10 years' time, what do you think search is going to be like? We're obviously going to have a lot of interesting new tools. Where do you think we'll be down the track?
That's a good question. I look back over the last 10 years, and I can remember a couple of big breakthroughs. You know, one of the things I think that excited me, back in the late 90s, this is long before I was involved in the search industry myself, was when search engines moved from just showing you the first 200 characters of each document to actually providing you little snippets that showed you where the words you were querying, where the words you typed in your query actually occurred within the document. And we're all very used to that now. Those little snippets really, really describe, you know, what's in the document. So I remember that as being one of those sort of breakthroughs. And, you know, it doesn't seem like a wow moment. You know, I think, it just seems like a simple technology, but I think that was something that really lifted search from, something that was difficult to use. You had to kind of go and inspect pages and go, oh, no, back. You had to sort of this frustrating mode you're in into something where you could really look at that results page and get a really good idea which results were likely to be good for your query. So I think, that was one of those little breakthrough moments. And, we have them every now and then. But I guess, looking forward into the future, some of the things that will change will be simple things like that. You know, somebody will have a really great intuition and just adjust something slightly, and we'll all just sigh with relief that this blindingly obvious thing's been done. And then, of course, there's just going to be, more constant reinvestment and innovation in the areas you'd expect. You know, I'm very excited about multimedia search. You know, I think video is now so prevalent and so easy to produce on your cell phone or with your cheap camcorder that's going to be an enormously popular space. Image search is obviously, continuing to grow. We're all putting our digital photos up online and sharing those, so that's going to be an area where there's continued investment and growth. Audio, as you pointed out, is a huge area. I'd love to see some really great technology in the music search space. I'd love to be able to say, hey, this is an audio file that I really like, I'm enjoying this. What other things are like that, and actually be able to find things that are similar in beat and style and length, and start to sort of explore a music space and get recommendations. Personalization is another big area, I think, where we need to make some gains. Somebody sent me a query today where they said, this is from Redmond, somebody said, I was searching for Typhoon, and it's a well-known Thai restaurant up in Redmond, and what I got was a news article about a typhoon in China. You guys need to fix this. And, my first reaction was, wow, we're doing a great job with our news instant answer. That's fantastic. But, clearly that wasn't what that particular user wanted. Being more personal, being more local, being more about, the context you're in. Are you at home? Are you at work? Is it nighttime? Is it daytime? And getting a little bit more sensitive about those kinds of aspects, and then sort of moving towards really personalizing the experience for you is something that's going to be important. And the last one I guess I'm really excited about is this whole social aspect. We're all out there sharing and tagging and uploading and downloading and, you know, storing things, you know, trying to share them with friends, joining communities, those kinds of things. And I think bringing all those aspects of your sort of network and your behaviors into search is a really, really exciting space. So I think it'll become more personal. I think it'll become more multimedia. And I think there'll just be these really sensible little breakthroughs that you know, we'll just take for granted and sigh with relief when they happen. And they're the ones that I love the most. You know, I think that's what really got me excited about image search when we were working on it. You know, we just had a couple of really simplifying, sensible things like the smart scroll feature sort of come to us when we were looking at the data. You know, they're sort of things that seem obvious in hindsight. So I'm waiting for those to sort of pop out as well. I hope to be part of a few more of those.
Hugh, I don't think redundancy is something that you and your team have to ever worry about. So thank you very much for your time this evening on Tech Talk Radio. It's been an absolute pleasure. I've learned a lot, and hopefully we can do it again when you're in town soon.
Thank you, Andrew. It was great fun.
You're listening.
Dr. Ron?
Here I am listening.
Residual powers. And I've got some residual powers.
You can't turn off CDMA.
In terms of the volume,
over a stick your fingerprints. Now, this
we may have digressed.
Talk radio.
Bill Burgess also claimed the country would remain behind.
We used to think 600 kilometres.
Don't open things that are good that you're not expecting, even if they do appear.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the summer series of Tech Talk Radio. Adam Turner's a regular here on the Tech Talk Radio panel. As a journalist, he's a writer for the Melbourne Green Guide and the Melbourne Age, not to mention a few other publications and online services. Every week, Adam has a view on technology, and we call it A View from the Couch. Adam Turner's View from the Couch on Tech Talk Radio.
Google has unleashed a killer Android, and it would seem resistance is futile. Android is Google's new Linux-based operating system for mobile phones, to rival Symbian, Windows Mobile, and of course OS X thanks to the iPhone. A few years ago I would have added Palm OS to that list, but not anymore. There's been talk of a Google phone for a long time. The aim, of course, is to put advertising on the smaller screen, which one assumes would subsidize the cost of the phone and your calls. It will also naturally play nicely with Google's growing stable of location-based services such as Google Maps. The big question is the so-called Google phone still to come, or will Android just assimilate existing hardware manufacturers? Rather than release the definitive Google phone like the iPhone, I'd say Google is more likely to license its OS to manufacturers such as HTC, which makes the iMate and Dopod range of smartphones. HTC has already announced it will release a device running Android in the European market next year. Until now, HTC devices have generally run the clunky Windows Mobile operating system, so Android is yet more bad news for Microsoft. Google will also be quick to release a software developer's kit and will certainly be much easier to deal with than Apple and the iPhone. Apple insists on controlling everything, the hardware, the software, so it refuses to license its operating system to other manufacturers and is very difficult to deal with when you're writing software for their platform. While this improves system stability, it also ensures that Apple remains a niche player. Google knows that hardware is irrelevant. Google also knows the operating system is irrelevant, and even the software is really irrelevant. It's all just a means to an end. Content and services are what it's all about. Android and the concept of the Google phone are just a platform that make it easy for people to consume Google services whilst looking at ads. Nothing else matters. The network is also becoming irrelevant, much to the dismay of telcos such as Telstra, who want to own the customer. As telecommunications becomes commoditized, Telstra doesn't want to just shift ones and zeros, it wants to offer services and content as well. As such, I'd expect to see Android phones available on the Hutchison 3 network before Telstra's next G. As for the iPhone, it might have slick graphics and a touchy-feely interface, but if Android tightly integrates Google services into a mobile device, then it will lay waste to the competition. Steve Jobs may have carried the iPhone down from the Mount Moses style, but I'd say an army that marches behind Android is invincible.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
If you were to ask anyone who uses the internet to name a search engine, or anyone who doesn't for that matter, chances are Google would be their response.
86% of Australians currently call Google home, so it's no wonder that when webmasters build and maintain websites, they do it with Google in mind. In recent times, Google has released a plethora of tools in an effort to educate and provide web designers a free and easy way to make their sites more Google and search engine friendly. Lydia Davis caught up with Adam Lasnik, Google's search engine evangelist based at Mountain View, California, to put a real voice behind those coloured letters we all know so well.
Today on Tech Talk Radio, we're visiting the Googleplex in Silicon Valley and having a chat with Adam Lasnik, Google's search evangelist. Adam's role at Google revolves around being a webmaster liaison. He spends most of his time monitoring webmaster forums and blogs. Adam's most visible role is speaking with and learning from webmasters around the world, particularly at conferences. He has just celebrated 1 year with Google. So, Adam, happy anniversary.
Welcome to
Tech Talk Radio.
Definitely a pleasure to be here.
Search engine optimization. Wow, what a buzzword in Australia at the moment.
SEO. Certainly, it's quite the thing here in the States as well. It's very much combined, I would say, a part of search engine marketing or SEM. So oftentimes people have looked at it as, how do we optimize our site for Google and for the other search engines? But I think maybe that's a little bit too narrow. The way I think is a better approach is, how do we optimize our site for users? And then from that, that typically translates into better crawling, indexing, and ranking on Google, and I would assume the other engines as well. So a lot of it has to deal with accessibility, compelling content, and oftentimes a lot of really simple tweaks that are both good for the user and good for Google.
Okay, what are they? What are the tweaks? We have to ask.
One of the ones that first comes to mind is actually the simplest, but one of the most powerful, and that's to optimize both your title tags and also your meta description tags. It's been surprising to me, actually, and sometimes scary to see even major companies having the same title and the same meta description on many, many pages. And since this typically shows up in Google search results, that doesn't tell the user very much. When they're getting ready to click, they look at it and they say, huh, that's not very descriptive. It's not something that I want to explore. So by refining that, by having a title that mentions the company name, describes what the page or that section is about, can really help both the user and also help your site's presence in Google as well.
What should people be thinking about when they do write the meta tags?
You want to think of it as, particularly for the meta description tag, as a brief and targeted description, not a series of keywords. It can actually be a sentence or a phrase, so that it looks like something you would how you would describe your page to someone else in just a brief moment of speaking. If it looks spammy to a user, it's probably going to look spammy to us, so you want to avoid that.
Because that seems to be the common question, you know, how many keywords, what about the meta tags, what about the title, you know, and this, you know, how many keywords, I mean, what a question.
Well, we get that a lot on many different aspects of search engine optimization and site optimization overall. You know, what should be the keyword density, exactly how long should my page be? And the answer really is, use common sense. You don't want to have a keyword density, for instance, such that it just reads obnoxiously. Mm-hmm. You don't want to have a page where you have to scroll to the point where your hand gets sore on the mouse.
That's
but
okay.
Similarly, having pages that are two sentences long so people have to click next, next, next. We look at it from the perspective of what would a user want to see, what is actually useful. And so we base our algorithms around that. So there really is no set number, no set ratio.
In terms of links, that's something you haven't mentioned yet, but people do ask about all links and what should we do. If you're going to be putting something out there, you want to make sure that it reflects directly on what you are talking about.
Oh,
because
yeah.
Otherwise, what's the point? And if you do have hundreds of links, I mean, what's it going to do? So tell me about links a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, you actually, just stepping back, you touched on sort of a fun aspect that I think people don't pay enough attention to. Actually, both a fun and important aspect. They're thinking, hey, let's get as much traffic as we can. Let me get as many hits. Let me rank number one. Without always thinking about the more core subject here, what are we going to do with these folks when they come to the site? Is that page actually relevant? Okay, we've link baited this huge section of people. Congratulations. But if they hit your page and they go, yeah, this is pretty dumb, and they hit back, you've just used a lot of bandwidth. You've perhaps lost some brand or some site goodwill. So the thing to think about with links is relevance. You want to be getting links to your site that are relevant to the content you have and you want to be linking to other pages from your site that are also relevant to what your users are probably looking for. Now, if you want to link, if you have like a personal site and you want to link to your uncle's dentistry blog and your site's not about dentistry, you know, who cares? That's great. That's fine. It's not that we're looking over every single link with a fine-tooth comb. We look at patterns, both incoming and outgoing. If it makes sense for the user, if it's not clearly spammy or obnoxious, then it's probably fine and it could definitely help the way we view and index and rank your site. People joke and they say, oh gosh, if I see another, the top 10 ways to do such and such. And you know, it's become a bit of a cliche and a bit of a joke from that phrasing. But at the same time, I think the way we perceive link baiting is, if that content is indeed compelling, if it's relevant to what the links are coming in, then hey, more power to you. You're providing something that entertains, informs, or is useful to users, and that's great.
Well, that gets rid of my next question, which was, if I'm a supplier, should I get my customers to link back to me? And you think, absolutely.
Yeah, this is one important consideration in that context. We see this all the time, for instance, with blog software or form software. It says powered by such and such on the bottom, on the footer. And, you know, that's fine. We certainly don't see that as a problem at all, as long as it's visible and not hidden. But we do want, there's one caveat there, and that the site where that's linking into shouldn't assume that if they have 80,000 links on powered by such and such to their site, they shouldn't assume that's 80,000 votes, because that wasn't placed there typically affirmatively by that other site. So we'll see it as votes, but there is a point of diminishing returns.
Tell me about regional filters, because this is something way back when I was in Australia, 1 year ago, way back, I would use Google a lot, but we would get google.com.au. Here, that's not the case. And is there any regional filters that...
Absolutely. I think they're more subtle than a lot of people think. We're definitely not completely rearranging or including brand new content or indexing completely different content by region. Rather, we're essentially massaging what people see largely based on regional, cultural, and linguistic differences. For instance, one of the oft-noticed differences between England, Australia, and the States is the word football. So we think of something different when you say the word football. And there's also just minor linguistic changes. Like I remember when I first came to Europe and I said, excuse me, where's the restroom? And they looked at me like I was totally batty.
Yeah.
So what we try and do is we try and take that into account, those differences, and interpret what people are searching for, and then view, based upon where they are, how might they be looking for something that's different than what someone in America would be looking for. And so we may slightly re-rank some of the results, or include a couple results here and there that would be different for someone in Australia than, say, in Japan or the United States.
So you do the hard work for the webmaster.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's, you know, you bring up the webmaster in this, of course, and I think some webmasters have been concerned, like, hey, I can't predict my ranking when my client is seeing something different here or from my site, the results are different in this country and that country. But we really see it as a win, not only for the user, but for the webmaster as well, because we're spreading the love. We're creating a set of results that the person in each country is more likely to click on and see as relevant. And that's better for the webmaster, it's better for the user.
Is there anything that businesses should be thinking about? In Australia, you've got to think, the other thing is we don't have the large corporations. I suppose we do have some, but not as many as you'd find, especially right here. And they don't have the money to spend on SEO and stuff like that. What are the key considerations for them?
Well, the most important thing is to speak with an authentic voice and with a language that reflects your primary audience. So if you are primarily intending to reach fellow Australians, write with a tone and with a spelling that reflects what Australians would expect to see. Spell harbour in the right way.
Yeah. Mum in the right way.
Exactly. refer to different cultural aspects and use language that is something people would expect. If you're trying to hit multiple audiences, that becomes a little more challenging, in which case I would pick a primary audience and spell and write for them. But then if there are specific regional differences that, for instance, Americans need to know some tourist information that every Australian would already know, include separate pages for them. Even if some of that content is overlapping, that's fine. That's not a problem. You know, we want to discourage, of course, absolute duplicate or identical content, particularly when it's intended to deceive. And I'm sure that's not something that your listeners, or frankly the majority of webmasters, are trying to do when they take segments of content and repeat it. we don't penalize for that sort of thing. We see it as essentially an attempt to communicate with different audiences and with, you know, slightly different nuances, and that's fine.
What does blogging do for someone that has a website?
You know, when it makes sense for that site's audience, blogs can be fabulous. It's important to realize that just starting a blog for the sake of, well, it's going to improve my ranking, it's probably not going to be too effective in itself, because if you don't blog because you feel passionate about a particular subject or about your products, it's going to show, mm-hmm. and people are going to not come back and not look at that favorably with your brand. But in the majority of cases where you do feel passionate about something, a hobby, a product, a service, blogging about that is a way to share your authentic voice. Mm-hmm. It's a way to have frequently refreshed content, mm-hmm. And also to start a conversation, assuming you have comments turned on, to start a conversation with your visitors. And they love that typically, where they can ask you questions or give feedback and get a response directly from someone that represents that company or that organization. They're more likely to come back to see follow-ups. They're more likely to share it with their friends. So blogs inherently are best for in a user context this way.
Absolutely.
And the side benefit is that because there tends to be additional rich content, it's going to probably be beneficial for the search engines as well. The only warning on blogs is that, like any good writing and like any good site management or writing actually for sites outside of blogs, it takes time, it takes effort to write content that's interesting, compelling, funny, useful, and also to manage comments, to be able to actually not just leave those comments out there, but to participate in a conversation. So if a company is going to go down that route, it's something you want to carefully think of and make sure you have the resources and the dedication, like any aspect of your site, to really see through in a quality way.
Is there any technical differences in terms of optimizing a blog compared to optimizing a website?
There's one consideration that comes to mind, and that's that In the case of blogs, sometimes duplicate content can be an unintentional issue where you will show the exact same article at 3 or 4 or 5 different URLs. And that can both confuse Google and can also confuse your users, because when they want to bookmark a particular article and share it with their friends, if they have the chance of bookmarking or linking to one of 3 or 4 different links, well, when you refine your blog, some of those links may go bad after a time. And it also can diffuse the page rank and other signals that enable us to see which pages are most relevant and important. And we see that most frequently in blog and also content management systems on the whole. So it is important to make sure that you have one URL, and this applies for all sites, one URL for each page of content.
Now, the operators that you have, I think, are brilliant. It's just that people don't know that they exist half the time, which is bizarre.
You know, it's an interesting tension for us, because on one hand, coming back to the same thing we were discussing, that we want to make searching so intuitive for the user that they don't have to change or adapt the way they search. But on the flip side, we know there are a ton of power users that want to be able to really drill down and specify, you know, in URL colon.
Yes.
Or, well, actually, here's one for your listeners that I think is super useful and not terribly difficult. Site colon.
Yeah.
So when you know that, for instance, on a particular American university site, Princeton.edu, mm-hmm. there was this great article you read, you could type in then site colon Princeton.edu, and then the name of the article or word from the article, and that will only show you pages on that site. We can do a better job of explaining, you know, how we work and what we do. And I think over time we have been doing a better job with this, but, you know, there's still room for improvement.
How often does Google index?
The answer isn't as straightforward as you probably like. We are indexing much more rapidly now than we did before. However, it also depends on the site. So when we see, for instance, a really prominent news site, or even a blog that tends to refresh its content and add new good content regularly, as we see that, we adjust the crawling rate for that particular site. So we will crawl it more often, and then also tend to index those pages more often. So there's really no set time. It depends on what we see and how often that particular site is updating. One brief note on the same topic. We recently added a pretty neat tool in the Webmaster Central, where you can tell us actually to crawl us either slower, or in some instances, if we've been holding back, you can tell us to crawl faster or crawl more. And over time, we'll be giving more and more of this control and offering the opportunity for webmasters to tell us how they want us to crawl their site. But we've gotten a bunch of feedback. Like, help, you're pummeling my server, and I haven't ramped it up yet. Or, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting because I saw that, and I was thinking, why would anyone want you to index less frequently?
Yeah, sometimes when I was in grad school, yeah. I ran a web server on my stupid little computer. That could only handle like a few queries at a time. It was just for fun. It was like for my friends.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the time, some search engines were discovering it. And they could also be pummeling it really hard, going through, okay. you know, a lot of pages very quickly. And then my friends couldn't view the pages. Now, that's an extreme example.
Yes.
But if you're even a larger site with a real, honest server, and you have a ton of pages, you may not want to have, for whatever reasons, bandwidth concerns, etc., you may not want to have us hit it as hard. Now, with that said, I think we've done really a stellar job at naturally not crawling too quickly. But, you know, just in case, we want to give webmasters that opportunity to say, hey, hold back for a bit.
And, of course, the final question, how many servers does Google have?
Oh, wow, that's fun. You know, I don't know how many of your listeners are fans of Douglas Adams.
One, yeah.
One? Oh, we have one. So I do have to admit, it is one of my favorite answers that I have given before, but it still remains compelling. And the answer is 42.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you so much for talking with Tech Talk
Definitely
Radio today.
Definitely a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1-300-664-882 and leave a voice message. That's 1-300-664-882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link.
You're listening.
Dr. Ron,
here I am listening.
Residual powers.
And I've got some residual powers.
You can't turn off CDMA.
In terms of the volume,
over a stick of fingerprints. Now, this
we may have digressed.
Talk radio.
Bill Burgess also claimed the country would remain behind.
We used to think 600 kilometers.
Don't open things with those good that you're not expecting, even if they do a thing.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
With the price of copper on the increase, thieves are again stealing cables and overhead power lines, hitting railways, electrical substations, and other infrastructure. An incident on the 5th of November in Melbourne left early morning commuters stranded after thieves removed copper cabling used to control the signals and boom gates at an eastern suburbs railway crossing. A Connex spokeswoman, Kate de Klerk, said that copper theft had been on the increase this year.
We've had over 20 incidents of copper theft since the start of September. It's resulted in more than 500 trains being delayed and more than 15 trains cancelled. It's a huge inconvenience to customers and it's very frustrating for us.
Here's Detective Senior Sergeant Brian Clark, officer in charge of the Victoria Police Transit Criminal Investigation Unit.
In recent times there's been an increase in copper wire thefts on the system, on and off the system, I believe. Well, what we believe is happening is that they're stealing the copper wire and they're selling it at various scrap metal dealers.
But the problem is not just limited to Melbourne or indeed Australia. Early this year in March, the state Senate in Oklahoma approved a measure intended to curb the growing problem of copper theft. A new bill has introduced additional regulations for second-hand dealers to make it easier for law enforcement authorities to track down copper thieves. Senator Cliff Brannan said action was required to curb a dramatically increasing problem throughout the state of Oklahoma.
We're asking some of the junk dealers to do a tag and hold where they would need to hold the particular metal that's being pawned for a 15-day period of time, and to also ask the person selling the copper to show some sort of proof of identification and how they came into possession of the copper.
Senator Brannan said the bill would also increase penalties for junk dealers who failed to adhere to state regulations on copper theft. The fine for a first offence would increase from $50 to $500, and the second offence would result in a $2,500 fine. Subsequent offences could even result in the junk dealer's licence being revoked. But copper theft is nothing new. The Postmaster General's Department, as Telstra was known in the 1950s, was forced to devise its own ways to detect copper theft and to report offenders to police. Former PMG Technical Officer Graham Gall spoke to Tech Talk Radio and explained how copper theft was managed in Australia 50 years ago.
Copper theft of wire, Ron, is not new at all. While I was in the Long Line branch of the Country Division in the city, most of the telephone trunking was via cable, but the shorter trunking routes, particularly along the railway lines, were all open aerial. There was no such thing in those days as coaxial cable, and quite often we would lose circuits, particularly around Gisborne and Woodend and Macedon. They would just automatically, or for no reason at all, just go down. And we technicians in City West Exchange devised some DC circuits to put over these copper wires to ensure that their continuity was maintained. I remember being on duty one night at 10 p.m. and three alarms went off, and we found that they were on the main trunk route going to Bendigo. Now, Bendigo was one of the main trunk routes through to Sydney, and they were aerial wires, not cable. The alarms went off. We did some tests. We had what we called radar on wire, and we rang the police. And the police found the would-be thieves, or the alleged thieves, along the railway embankment, merrily cutting down the copper wires, rolling it up, and taking it home.
So copper theft is nothing new, and does in fact appear to be on the rise. And apart from the short-term inconvenience of cancelled train services and power blackouts, taxpayers are also affected by rising insurance premiums, power bills, and even the cost of new homes, as cables are frequently stolen from building construction sites. The Energy Networks Association is a national body representing gas and electricity distribution companies throughout Australia. They're very concerned about copper theft, and in particular, theft of copper cable, copper straps, and copper bus bars. Andrew Blythe from the ENA explains that when it comes to copper theft, consumers are the ultimate losers.
This activity is dangerous, it's stupid, and it must stop. It's something that Australian consumers may have to actually bear in mind in the future, that this may flow through to their electricity bills. And we would actually be calling for a national action plan to be developed to address this major issue.
So apart from good old-fashioned police work, what's being done to tackle the problem in Australia? One company is distributing a data dot technology similar to that used on some new motor vehicles. The New South Wales company, Data Dot Commercial, is the primary distributor of a new technology known as Data Dot DNA. This entails thousands of tiny microchips encoded with a company's name and identification number being sprayed over a length of copper cable. Data dots are not visible to the naked eye and can only be seen under ultraviolet light. Despite the inherent dangers of serious injury and even electrocution, rail operators, utilities companies and police still find themselves battling with thieves who are simply chasing a quick dollar, oblivious to the impact that their actions are having on the community. Hopefully, the emergence of new legislation, combined with security technology, will start to decrease the incidence of copper theft. If you notice suspicious activity near a railway line or a construction site or an electrical substation, contact your local law enforcement authority straight away. In Australia, ring 000 for urgent police attendance.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio's summer series, and we'll be back next week when Dr. Ron Smith presents more of the best of the last 3 years of the show. Visit the Tech Talk Radio website for all the information on past shows, and feel free to send us an email and say hello. And don't forget the Tech Talk Radio forum at forum.techtalkradio.com.au. Here you can share your thoughts and dilemmas with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners. So that's Tech Talk Radio for this week. Until next week, behave yourselves over the festive break, stay safe, and be sure to tune in to the station you're listening to right now in 2008 for your weekly fix of tech news, gadgets, politics, scuttlebutt rumours, and facts in the technological world. I'm Andrew McComb, and on behalf of everyone here at Tech Talk Radio, see you next week, and thanks for listening. Tech Talk Radio is brought to you each and every week by a band of dedicated professionals from within the broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer and host Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins, expert opinion from Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications, and podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night from 8 p.m. The crew wish to thank all the stations that take the show, including 3WBC, 3XX, Cairns FM, Highlands FM and Queer FM in Western Australia. Tech Talk Radio is available for syndication on your local station. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit the website techtalkradio.com.au for more information. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.